26 minutes past the hour, it being Wednesday, it being an awfully good day to talk with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. Doug is out in Columbia, Maryland this morning. And Doug, good morning to you. It's good to have you back. I'm excited to get on to Elizabeth and Zechariah Part 2. We got into the real beginning of Advent last week, and that's the treat in store for today. But David has a question for you.
You've been to Israel a number of times.
And, yes.
And the, you know, the big, well, not the big news, but one of the pieces of news this morning is that President Trump has repeated his pledge on the campaign trail that he intends to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Then the news is always, he's reacted. I mean, if Donald Trump likes it, they don't like it. So that's just kind of a given. Do you think it's a good idea? Would it be a positive thing for the surroundings in Jerusalem or the country? Or, I mean, the standard disagreement has been, but it'll hurt the peace process. And my usual response is, what peace process is that?
Yeah. Well, as you might guess, everything has sort of a contextual backdrop to it. Even when we deal with contemporary times in Israel. I would suggest you have to view what just happened through the grid of the ultimate solution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. For an increasingly number of people, the two-state solution is seen as inevitable. But Netanyahu seems to be a hawk, if you want to use that word here, for a one-state solution. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, public opinion seems to be shifting in Israel towards the two-state solution. And it's embraced by many, many ex-military people who understand the security issues as well. And so the move by the United States to shift the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, I think will be seen by many as an affirmation that Jerusalem is the capital of the Jewish nation, the Jewish state, and therefore might legitimize the Israelis formally annexing East Jerusalem, mm-hmm. which, if they do that, really makes the two-state solution ever more difficult. And so there's a whole series of dominoes here that some people view as not being helpful with this decision that the U.S. has just done. I won't pass judgment on it one way or another. I will say from an Islamic perspective, Temple Mount is the third most holy site in Islam. And if this is seen as helping to legitimize annexing East Jerusalem to West Jerusalem and having a unified city, that is then seen as a way to take control of the third holiest site in Islam. And that comes with all sorts of issues. So it's complicated and it's got layers.
Yes, it does.
Okay, would this kind of aid and abet, or at least encourage those who are looking for the final solution, the end times, maybe construction of the second temple? I mean, there's ultimately we see conflict happening there, Armageddon.
From the perspective of those who want to reassert control over Temple Mount and resurrect Herod's temple, for lack of a better phrase here, from the grid of the end times, this would be seen as a positive move. Mm-hmm. But there's a wide variety of viewpoints within the whole end times world as well. And so that in of itself is a controversial topic.
Okay. Well, listen, we got into something not so controversial, but still hidden from most of us. We don't have eyes to see. And you're enlightening us with the story of Elizabeth and Zechariah. And I'd asked you last week rather pointedly, what's the beginning? And I kind of teased you. I said, it must have been when Mary and Joseph arrived late that night in Bethlehem with she on a donkey and no room at the inn. All the clothes signs were out. And you said, no. The real beginning of the story goes back a few months prior to that. Let's pick up where we left off. Elizabeth and Zechariah. Why should we remember them?
Well, because Luke deems them incredibly important for understanding the birth of Jesus. That's why they take up most of the first chapter of his scroll that we know as the Gospel of Luke. And last week, we did not get through the fifth verse first chapter.
That's true. There's a lot there.
We dealt with in the time of Herod, the king of Judah, and then we dealt with there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. And now we pick up the end of the fifth verse. His wife, Elizabeth, was also a descendant of Aaron. Okay, so wow, is there a lot of context in the white spaces between those two phrases in that verse? So let's back up. Zechariah gets born. His father gives him that name, Zechariah. We talked last week, it means whom Jehovah remembers. It's probably the most prophetic name in Judaism because it harkens back to the prophet Zechariah, who probably made the boldest predictions about Messiah. And so after Zechariah was born, and on the eighth day, given his name, Zechariah, he grows up. And I don't know when it was, when he was maybe 14, 15, 16, who knows. His father came home one day and said to his wife, "Such a deal I did today. We brokered a deal here where Zechariah is going to marry a young girl named Elizabeth." And she, Elizabeth, is the name of Aaron's wife. Aaron is the first chief priest of Israel. If you felt you had a special son, which I suspect Zechariah did, this is the perfect wife, Elizabeth. And so there was a betrothal contract signed up and a dowry negotiated. And if this proceeds according to normative times here, when Zechariah is about 18 or 20 years of age, and Elizabeth is 12 and a half or 13, they got married. And in this culture, you'll have a multi-day wedding feast, sometimes 5 days long. And can you imagine the celebration? Can you imagine the pride of Zechariah's father that he had done his job? He had found a marvelous wife for his son. And surely God had something special in store for this couple.
So both were in the priestly line then.
Absolutely. She came out of it from a very special way, tracing her lineage back to Aaron. So as the wedding feast ended, I suspect everyone in the clan who was at the wedding looked at this perfect young couple and just began to wonder, how many priestly sons are they going to have? Surely God is going to bless them. This just seems like a marriage made in heaven. And I suspect Zechariah and Elizabeth felt that same way as well. Won't take long now, and we'll start to have our own priestly sons to carry on the line, because you can only become an ordinary priest if you're born of ordinary priests. Okay? It's the only way you get into the ordinary priesthood. So for the first 5 years, no pregnancy. Well, we all know of some couples for whom it took some time. So let's just be patient here. Year 7, 8, and 9, and nothing happened. Year 10, no pregnancy. Now there's a further backdrop here. The rabbis have taught, because the sole role of a woman in this culture is procreation, that if your wife is barren in the 10th year of marriage, you need to divorce her and get another wife. That's the cultural expectation. That's the religious recommendation, okay? So what we fail to realize here is the integrity it took for Zechariah to say no. No to all the people in his clan who were giving him that advice. No to the Pharisees and the rabbis who were giving him that advice. He stood his ground and said, no, I'm going to stay married to Elizabeth. That took courage, guts, okay, fortitude. Well, then it goes 15 years and no pregnancy. And how many times haven't they tried already? How many times did they try and shortly thereafter realize it failed again? And then they get to be married 20 years and there's no pregnancy. And to my way of calculation here, about the 30th year that they're married is when all this stuff happens. But if we push the rewind button on that, let's say when they have their 25th, 26th, 27th anniversary of being married, still no pregnancy. 1 month, they sat around the dinner table and a profound sense of sorrow came over them because they realized menopause had just set in. Okay? Now, any hope of a child, let alone a priestly son, is gone. It's over. Your dreams have been dashed.
How did Elizabeth weather the storm? I mean, what's the pressure on her?
We totally miss this. They live in an honor and shame culture. The rabbis run this observant Jewish culture. And one of the rulings, if you want to use that word, that they have promulgated is that there are only two reasons you can argue that God doesn't like you, that he's disciplining you for your own good. And those two exceptions are leprosy and childlessness. Okay? She would have been seen as a social leper by everyone in the village, by everyone in her neighborhood, by everyone in her clan. Somehow, God has chosen to dislike them. Nobody knows the reason why, but it is incontrovertible evidence. You are barren. We know God doesn't like you. And if he doesn't like you, we're not going to like you. What was it like after maybe the 10th anniversary to start to be shunned by everyone in your village? Every morning when the women put their water pots out in their heads and go out to get water, Elizabeth doesn't accompany them. She's not welcome. She always goes to the well alone. What is it like to be shamed by your culture for 15 or 20 years? To be persona non grata, okay? In the 25th verse of the first chapter, she said, "The Lord has done this for me," pregnancy. "In these days, he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace amongst the people." The word disgrace there is a weak one. It should be shame, okay? Mm-hmm. It's an honor and shame culture. So the weightiness of this just gets lost because we don't appreciate the context of this couple. And so that's where they are. He's about to be in his last year of being in the ordinary priesthood. You could only be in the service for 30 years. I think it started, some say, people say it started at 20. Some people say it started at 30. So he's either 50 years old or 60 years old. He's in the last year of service here when he then goes into the chamber of hewn stone for yet another selection of who's going to do the incense offering. And lo and behold, in his last year, he is selected at one of these events. And maybe we ought to pick that theme up next week.
Mm-hmm. So Elizabeth would have been in her early 40s probably at that point.
Oh, no.
Well, she was 30 years after she was 12.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's 60.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that make her, 52?
Well, she could have been older. I mean,
could have been. We're just guessing here.
Yeah.
But menopause has come for sure.
Interesting. Yeah.
Their dreams have been dashed. It is now virtually impossible. There is no hope. And this is part of the motif of Advent to get us ready for the arrival of his son, because now there is going to be incredible hope.
And we get just a glimpse today of how deep the story is with Elizabeth and Zechariah. And we'll learn more next week as we again join Doug and well, you know, it's going to be impossible to get all this in before Christmas. We've got so much to cover here.
Well, we can do a little compression, but we need to set the tone, the motif of
the event. We're learning what's between the lines in the book of Luke, and that's a good thing. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. By the way, their website is a beautiful website. You can go there, sign up for Doug's monthly newsletter, his Reflections newsletter. It's preservingbibletimes.org. And if you're listening on our site this morning, brokenroadradio.com, you can link there with a click and discover what Preserving Bible Times has to offer. Doug, have a great week. We'll see you next week, okay?
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, bye-bye.
See you, Doug.